This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our monthly gardening show today. We'll spend the next full hour talking with our local experts and taking your phone calls and emails. So be ready. Share what's on your mind about gardens, plants, flowers, trees, landscaping, bugs, pests, whatever. Call 513-419-7100 or email talk at wvxu.org. Today, we're joined by Hamilton County Extension Agent Joe Boggs. Hi, Joe. Welcome back.
How you doing, Michael? I'm glad to be back.
I'm doing well, and we're glad to have you back. And Waterfield's Director of Greenhouse Operations and Adjunct Professor at the University of Cincinnati's Horticultural Program, Joshua Jones. Joshua, welcome back to our show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Again, the number to join today's conversation, 513-419-7100, or email your thoughts to talk at wvxu.org. Before we get to phone calls and emails, Joe, I was reading this article about some supercharged poison ivy. It was published by The Grist, and I want to read just a brief part of it to get our conversation going. Quote, "If you live in areas where there is a lot of poison ivy, you may have noticed that the plant appears to be thriving lately. The leaves are looking leafier, the vines more prolific. Your poison ivy rash may even feel more itchy. It's not your imagination. Research shows that the main culprit behind climate change is increased supercharged poison ivy." Joe, are we seeing supercharged poison ivy?
Well, you know, we are, Michael. And this is interesting because I think a lot of gardeners, I mean, I'm hearing it and myself included, you know, you do go out and you say, I just don't remember poison ivy being this bad. I mean, of course, we always say that because our memories are flawed about numerous things. But over time, it just became to me and to others apparent that it does seem to be that something's going on. And then, now not everyone is highly susceptible to the rashes caused by the active ingredient in poison ivy and other members of the group. Urushiol is the chemical that causes the rash. And not everyone's highly sensitive, but it also seemed to me, and again, this is anecdotal. You say, well, seemed like I was hearing more reports of people having, you know, very severe reactions. Well, you know, had I been really checking the literature out, I would have known all the way back in 2006, a scientific publication that just tackled this very point about, it was titled Biomass and Toxicity Responses of Poison Ivy to Elevated Atmospheric CO2. That was 2006, and then along in 2007, rising atmospheric carbon dioxide and potential impacts on the growth and toxicity of poison ivy. So that online report that you read is based on real science. We're not imagining this, and it is true that it does appear that as we see elevated incidences, and by the way, this isn't just measured in the laboratory. This is also connecting atmospheric CO2 to what appears to be being seen. But the other thing that I thought was really interesting is not just that the biomass of the plants are getting bigger leaves, thriving better. It's also that the enhanced carbon dioxide is being used to produce urushiol by the plant that has a much greater toxic effect. So people aren't imagining it. It really is based, this is based on clear science, and it's a hard thing to read because, you know, no one likes poison ivy. Leaflets of three, leave it be. We always teach people that. But
three leaves, but leave it be? Is that what you said, three leaves?
Well, you know, I learned it, you know, leaves of three, leave it be, or three leaves, leave it be. Yeah, they're actually leaflets. I know Joshua will probably kick in, you know, because he's probably, you know, well, wait a second, Joe, you're an entomologist. What do you mean? They are poison ivy does have three leaflets. So, you know, to be perfectly accurate, we should be saying leaflets of three. But nonetheless, it is a pretty clear distinction. And Michael, some things you and I have talked about in the past, or at least we talked about a bit via email. You know, we've raised awareness of some other plants, poison hemlock, wild parsnip, you know, to say these are plants you should avoid. But all along, I mean, you know, my entire life, for example, all along, poison ivy was a plant to leave alone. And so we need to go full circle. Okay, we have some of these other non-native invasives. Yes, we need to be aware of those. But do not forget about poison ivy.
Definitely not.
And and another very important point is folks may be seeing poison ivy doing things that, I don't remember doing that. For example, you know, when you think of poison ivy, I think the typical image that comes to mind is this vine climbing up a tree. Well, that's one growth habit. It can also creep across the ground. And very often you don't see those plants creeping across the ground going up a tree. But the third form that can really throw you off is they can be small shrub-like plants, not on the ground, not climbing a tree, but looking like little shrubs or small trees. I have some pictures where, thankfully, I'm not very sensitive to urushiol, so I'm holding the top of the plant, and it is taller than me. I'm a little over 6 feet, and it looks like a tree. It's not being supported by anything. It's just growing straight up. So that brings up another point. So far, there are at least 8 different subspecies recognized for poison ivy. So it's not just one species and one plant type. So that's something else to be aware of, is that it can present itself in slightly different forms.
Well, before we get to the phone calls and the emails for today's gardening show, Josh, I want to give you an opportunity to weigh in. You're out in the fields and working with plants as well. Have you seen these super-powered mutant poison ivy that's ready to come for our lives?
So I completely agree with Joe. As I've seen it in many different forms, and I actually am battling poison ivy in my own yard, and I noticed this year it is just it's tougher and tougher to get rid of. It comes back faster and faster each time I try to chop it or smother it. So I actually just deployed our favorite method on this gardening show, is the flame leader.
Yes, the blowtorch.
Yeah, the old flame leader blowtorch, because it really thrives in disturbed ground. It is able to take root very well, and it grows a lot faster than the native plants around it. So I have taken a method of not disturbing the soil, and I am using the flame leader. And then the really important part is to come back and establish a plant behind it. Where there's a plant established, it's harder for the poison ivy to reestablish itself. And then one point that I like to make out is I found a very large vine going up one of my hemlock trees in my yard. And instead of trying to pull it down while it has all of its oils in it and they're producing oils, is I just cut the vine at the bottom and let that thing dry out for a few months before you try to pull it down. You'll have less contact with the oils. Now, the oils will still persist, so it's not completely safe. I still recommend wearing gloves, covering up, but it'll be less likely to give you that irritating rash.
That is
Joshua, when you burn the poison ivy, though, you try to stay with the with the smoke going away from you, right?
Yes, I do. And so I that's a great point, Joe, is I actually don't burn the poison ivy with the blowtorch. I put the flame on it so it wilts. And typically when I come back the next day, it is wilted and dead. I don't burn it with the blowtorch until it's on fire. All I'm trying to do is break down those cell walls with a little bit of heat. And it actually happens pretty rapidly. So typically the plant is not on fire, but that's a good point. If you are going to take a burning method, make sure that you're not inhaling those fumes because it will still irritate your lungs, and you can kind of get yourself into trouble there.
And just to reiterate how I introduced this segment, I printed up part of that article. It didn't print correctly, so I left off some keywords and may have sounded a little clumsy in reading it. But what it said about climate change is research shows that the main culprit behind this stronger poison ivy is climate change climate change in general is, quote, increased concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's what is supercharging poison ivy, according to grist.org. 513-419-7100 is the number to call to join our conversation. You can also email us at talk@wvxu.org. Let's get to the phone calls. We've got Janet on the line. Hi, Janet. What's your question or comment?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have a area that had 5 blue star junipers Two of them have died. The other three have severe browning. So I suspect I may have root rot disease. And the only way to really tell, of course, is if you dig them out. I haven't been able to, in my research, find any specific information on a recommended method for getting them out of the ground. Is it necessary? Is there a... Do you need to get all the roots? And then once you finally have them out, is there a recommended ground treatment for that specific area where they have been to protect the area from any other plants getting root rot disease? And then the secondary issue is regarding pH. I did have a soil sample done. My pH is 8.0. It was recommended that I use a nitrogen. Let's see. I'm sorry. Lost my place here.
Well, that's okay.
Nitrogen mixture to treat the ground with. But I have plants that are already growing, and they all have lower pH than that. Barberry, 6.0 to 7.5. Sedums, 5.95.
Janet, let's go ahead and start diving into some of your questioning here. I'm going to place you on hold and let our panel of experts here start to address some of that. So it sounds like Janet's Blue Star Junipers appear to have root rot, and she wants to know the best way to dig them out. Would that be best for Josh or Joe?
I want to pass this one along to Joe. I can certainly help with the soil pH, but
cool. Well, let's start with the root rot. We'll go to Joe first, and then Josh will toss it over to you when it comes time to analyze the pH situation. Joe, go ahead if you have anything.
First, just very quickly, and take a minute. Just make sure that if you're seeing browning of any type of conifers right now, you look for bagworms. I've gotten two or three emails where people weren't seeing that. Small blue spruce, for example, just half of it brown. Junipers, arborvitae, I mean, a large number of plants. So just make sure, not doubting what she's saying, I'm just saying for the listeners, if you're seeing browning conifers right now, you know, look for those little tiny bags because they're starting just now to become evident. But in terms of root rots, you know, we got to be a little careful about that. The pathogens that are responsible for that are by and large basically secondary, meaning that they get a good start, you know, once those plants are in a location where the roots are starting to die for whatever reason. It could be too much water through poor drainage or compaction. But the so-called root rotting pathogens are primarily what we call water molds. They're not actually fungi. And that's important because there are some products that are listed for being for suppressing water molds. Things like Phytophthora and Pythium, these are genera of different water molds, but they're not perfect. They're not very good. So in answer to the question, is there anything to treat the ground? No, there really isn't something unless you're in a nursery, and then that would justify this continuous treatment. But being in a landscaping, I really don't have a good answer on how to pop these out other than to dig them out. But don't get too carried away with what's left. If somebody said, well, you know, these plants are, you know, all the root systems infectious, that's simply not quite true. The pathogens are already in the soil. And yes, if these plants have died because of a root decaying pathogen, it means you have a higher concentration of that pathogen in that location. But there's really nothing that can be done about it, and leaving roots behind isn't going to increase it. It's just simply there already. Now, the pH issue, and Joshua, I'll stop in a second, but that is really bad. We don't have many conifers other than our, and this is important, our native juniper, you know, unfortunately called Eastern Red Cedar, it actually does well at high pH. It's, if you drive around Greater Cincinnati and look at where they grow, you know, they're growing where the pH is very high. It's one of the few junipers that actually can do that. So in terms of coming back with something, you know, that could be an option. Barberries actually do have a wide pH range. She mentioned that. And sedum does. So it could be the luck of the draw that some of these other plants are doing well, even with the pH being high. The soil test was a good move, though. Unfortunately, about the only way to drop the pH is by applications of sulfur. That takes time, and unfortunately, we're sitting on limestone here in Greater Cincinnati, much of our area. And so the pH is inherently going to always rise. So it goes back to picking plants that can withstand or can thrive, not withstand, can thrive in high pH.
All right, Josh, you wanted to offer a perspective as well, Joshua?
No, Joe pretty much covered it perfectly there.
All right. Well, we do appreciate that. Joe, Janet, was that helpful to you?
Recommend treating those for the high pH to lower the pH in the soil. I need to replant.
Okay. Janet, we'll see if we can figure out a way to treat that pH. So let's just take a few more seconds here. Joshua, I don't know if you have any advice on maybe treating that pH. I let Janet go, so we'll give her the answer here. She'll be offline for that. But if she wants to treat the pH level, which is 8.0, because she wants to plant other things.
Yeah, so 8.0 is a bit high. I typically want my soil to be around the 6.5 mark, and that's just because nutrient uptake, most of the nutrients are most available at that pH. And like Joe said, the plants that she currently has there do have a wide pH range. If she is interested in lowering that pH, again, agreeing with Joe, the sulfur is the best way when your pH is that high. So I would recommend you buying elemental sulfur that will give you an application rate. This is going to be something that typically is going to be done over several seasons because that is such a large pH jump or drop down. So what I would recommend doing is applying it at the recommended application rate, and then I would till it in on a light till just to kind of work it into the soil. That way it's not exposed to the elements. And the sulfur works best when you're applying it over 70 degrees. So you don't want to do it too early in the season. So right now would be a wonderful time to try to mix that in. And again, know that this is a long-term process to make that large of a change. Since the pH scale is a logarithmic scale, it is quite a large jump from 8 to 6.5.
Janet, we are definitely well over 70 degrees today, so this is the season for that, I suppose. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for the phone call. More callers in line. We're going to get to you momentarily. Your emails are coming in as well. Those are up next. We will continue with our experts, Joshua and Joe, on Cincinnati Edition's monthly gardening show on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It is our monthly gardening show where we spend the full hour talking about plants, flowers, trees, trouble you're having with those things, bugs, birds, pests, all that. We're joined today by Hamilton County Extension Agent Joe Boggs and Waterfields, Director of Greenhouse Operations, also an adjunct professor at the University of Cincinnati's Horticulture Program, Joshua Jones. And you, too, can join us at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Back to the phone lines now. We've got Andrew. Hi, Andrew. What's your question or comment?
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on here. I am a novice, brand new vegetable gardener. Moved into a house with a yard that's got a couple hundred square feet of gardenable space. And so I'm in my first foray into vegetable gardening, just enjoying the first tomatoes off the vine, cucumbers, the whole nine. But I've really gotten interested in permaculture, in what it would take to grow some food, some vegetables in the winter months. And so my question, because I've seen some conflicting information online, is about this time of year in the summer, what should I be doing to get ready for growing some vegetables through the winter? What plants should I be thinking about, starting seeds, and when? What should I be doing with my soil? And what should I do? How can I prepare to sort of go through the quote-unquote scene change between my summer crops and into my winter crops? When do I need to get those into the ground? And I'm dreading the moment. Will I have to rip out tomato plants, for example, to make room for winter crops when the time comes?
Andrew, thank you so much for the call, and we'll turn it over to our experts now. He's looking for some advice on when to start planting for the winter, relatively new to having a garden space and is interested in permaculture. Joshua, you want to start?
Sure. So I love the idea of planting a fall garden. I think fall gardening is so much more successful than spring gardening. There are typically less things that can go wrong, and the produce is, quite frankly, it tastes so much better because the fruit is coming on in the cool season versus spring crops. The fruit is coming in the heat of summer, so it tastes so much better. To answer some of your questions is, typically I will start my fall crops. I will want them either seeded or planted into the garden by about mid-August. What I'll typically do is, our frost date is October 15th. So I'll take that October 15th day and I'll work backwards from it. And that tells me when the plant needs to go in to be able to be ready by that October 15th frost date. So for example, if I'm going to grow broccoli, we'll say broccoli is about a 70-day crop. I'll start it October 15th. I'll count back 70 days, and that's when my broccoli crop needs to be started. So that's typically the way that I figure out the timing aspect of it. Now, a good crop list for you for the wintertime, almost all of your brassicas are going to be frost tolerant or cold hardy, if you will, with the exception of broccoli. It does not like to get a frost on it. So all of your brassicas, so cabbage, all of your root crops, carrots do really well, beets, parsnips, radishes, all those do fantastic with a little bit of coolness on them. I will tell you what I would do is to prepare to overwinter is start thinking about getting frost cloth now, which is a light cotton cover that you'll put over in the late season to protect some of your crops from the frost, and have that on hand. That way you're ready to deploy it in that October to November range. And all you do is simply cover that, making sure the cloth is not touching your crops. You want to use some sort of ribbing to create a rigid structure that you can lay the cloth over so it's not laying directly on your crops. And that'll give you a lot of frost protection. And then lastly, I'll say, without a greenhouse or a hoop house, it's very difficult to grow things through the winter. But what I tell people is, if you start on time, being planting your things in August, you can actually use your garden as a quote-unquote refrigerator. So my carrots will be ready in October, but I don't necessarily need to pull those when they're ready. I can leave them in the ground, and they're fully mature, so they're ready to pull, but they'll stay fresh in the ground, and you can go out and pull them as you need pretty much all the way through about January. And that's a really passive way to get fresh produce throughout the entire or the majority of the season. And lastly, I will say that there is going to be a point in time where, if you're out of space, you're going to have to make that decision of, do I pull out this tomato to plant my fall crop? I recommend pulling the tomatoes that are least productive. So typically this time of year, we have tomatoes slowing down, typically in this area because of early blight. You might consider taking out those diseased tomatoes, and you can plant things like brassicas and other root crops in that area, and the early blight won't bother them.
There you go, Andrew. I hope that was helpful for you.
Absolutely. Great. I mean, absolutely wonderful information. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We appreciate it. We'll go back to the phone lines momentarily, but we're also taking emails to talk at WVXU.org. Marilyn writes in wondering, is it too late to prune my viburnum? When should I prune my oak leaf hydrangea? Let's turn that over to Joe, maybe?
Well, yeah, because we're talking about, with these plants, we do have that. Let me just back up to say, you can almost prune any time. I mean, that's the first thing. People get overly concerned about pruning plants, and to some degree, we can do that. The thing you sacrifice, though, is whether or not the plants bloom on new wood or old wood. And so by that, I mean that, okay, if you prune right now, you may be pulling off some of the buds that will be, blooming for next season or not, just depending, again, on whether it's new wood or old wood. But I always use a rule of thumb. If something is out of hand, and I'm looking out my window for right now, for example, and I have a really nice hydrangea paniculata, and it's really getting wild. It's really getting out of hand. And just in for the sake of mowing and for the sake of trying to bring it back into form, now I may be doing some pruning that's outside the generally recommended time. So you can prune anytime. Look into whether that particular, and the reason why I'm kind of hedging on hydrangeas is because hydrangeas can be different, and viburnums as well. So you need to find out, okay, exactly which, you know, what do you have, and when, you know, old wood, new wood bloom. But if you need to prune, you need to prune, and don't let that get in the way.
Well, good luck, Marilyn. And let's hear from Skylar, who writes in to say, could you please let me know the best time to protect my cucurbits from cucumber beetles? I've never successfully grown cucumbers, watermelon, or pumpkins because of them. That's Skylar. I hope I said that correctly. Is it cucurbits?
Yeah. Joshua, I may be an entomologist, but I'm going to call upon your expertise because I have a hard time with those, with striped and spotted cucumber beetles myself.
So what I've noticed is the cucumber beetle themselves typically aren't the problem, as in they're typically not biting, eating, sucking, destroying your plants. But what they will do is they spread powdery mildew very effectively. So if you have powdery mildew and you see cucumber beetles, I might want to start treating for the powdery mildew sooner than later, because they will spread that back and forth very easily, and that really slows down the productivity of your plant. If it's a low-lying plant, being a smaller squash or a pumpkin, you can certainly try to hand pick it, maybe use a little diatomaceous earth around not only the base of the plant, but some of the younger leaves themselves, because if they do feed on the plant, that's where they're at, the younger succulent leaves. So try to treat with diatomaceous earth first, and then you can cover them with that same thing that I recommended to the last caller. It's a floating row cover. The brand could be Agribon or Rime. It's all the same. But covering them will mechanically keep those cucumber beetles out. If it is a large trellis cucumber, it's going to be very difficult to cover that. So I would recommend diatomaceous earth there to try to deter those insects away. But I have a feeling that if she's getting damage on her plants, it's most likely not the cucumber beetle. It could very well be a squash beetle, because they also love those same set of plants, and they will typically do more actual mechanical damage to your plant. But the prescription would be the same: to hand pick them off and try to cover them up the best you can. The mechanical covering is the best tool that we have against those two insects.
All right, Skylar, good luck with those beetles, regardless of the variety that it might be on your cucurbits. All right, we'll be back in the inbox momentarily. Let's check out the phone lines now. We've got Neil on the line. Hi, Neil. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I have supercharged poison ivy in my front yard, and it's also in the same area where last summer I cut back a tree of heaven, and it's resprouting like crazy. I tried treating it with, actually I had poison ivy spray that I sprayed on, you know, the cut, I guess, trunk. And I was warned that Tree of Heaven likes to come back. You know, it's more like the tree from hell.
Well, speaking of hell, Joshua, you had recommended using the flames and also replanting in that spot, right?
Yeah, I think establishing something else in the soil is certainly going to help. You know, poison ivy, and especially the supercharged poison ivy, it will try to certainly outcompete. If it doesn't have anything to compete against, then it will certainly flourish very quickly. So I think reestablishing something in that area would be very beneficial. If you don't mind, and I couldn't hear if she was trying to get rid of the Tree of Heaven as well, or if she was trying to reestablish that Tree of Heaven.
Neil,
but if you don't mind,
Neil, go ahead and let us know. What were you trying to?
I was trying to get rid of it, because at first I mistook it for, I thought, oh, black walnut, and then I smelled the peanut butter smell when I broke off a leaflet, you know, and so I realized it may come back, but it's just trying to resprout like crazy in the same area where I have the supercharged poison ivy.
So I'm not sure where it is in your lawn, but I might recommend a smothering technique of solarization. So you can put a piece of black plastic down and, you know, put some bricks over that area. If it's somewhere where you're trying to make it look, you know, a little bit more intrinsically good, I might consider putting plastic down and maybe mulch down. That way it just doesn't look like you have plastic in your yard. But smothering has been a great technique. And basically when it tries to regrow, it has a barrier that's blocking the sunlight, and eventually it will not be able to survive on the sugars that it has stored in its roots, and you'll be able to successfully kill both the poison ivy and your tree of heaven. Now, the poison ivy will send out roots, and it might be a little bit tougher. It might come out sides of the plastic, so I would keep an eye on that area. But the flame weeder and the solarization methods are the best non-chemical methods. Now, Joe might have some information on a chemical method that might be really good at treating both of those.
Yeah, if you do, Joe, very quickly, we've got to get to another caller.
That's right, yeah. Tree of Heaven spreads by underground rhizomes. Their stems underground, so there's a saying that if you cut down one tree of heaven, you know, all the relatives show up for the funeral. So that's what she's dealing with. And Joshua, maybe the plastic would work, although I've seen these regrowths, they spike up and they can actually penetrate plastic.
So, plastic.
Yeah, it may be, you may need to do some spot Roundup treatments or, you know, and be very careful with what you use. You used a poison ivy killer, you said a minute ago, but that could be a little bit, those chemicals may last longer. So you may want to go with something that lasts a lot shorter and is very specific, you know, to taking out the green part. So glyphosate Roundup would be something, but you're going to have to keep at it. Again, it's very hard to get rid of. You got a lot of energy underground with those rhizomes.
Neil, I hope that was helpful for you.
It does help. It makes me feel a little bit better that, you know, it's not me.
Well, good luck with it. We appreciate the phone call and that you're listening. And we'll check out a call from James now. Hi, James. What's your question or comment?
How's it going? I have I believe are red buds that have taken over my yard. They start out like little weeds, and they grow into trees very quickly. I believe they're part of the pea family, and I just can't seem to get them out of, you know, they root deep. They you know, you think they're weeds, and you go to pull them, and they're just like, you can't get them out of the ground, and they just keep shooting up everywhere, and I'd like to try to eliminate some of these red buds. I believe they are red buds.
All right, stand by. And Joe, is this something you can help James with?
Yeah, in fact, I can, if misery loves company, I have a big red bud in the backyard. And even though they are native trees, they can be prolific seed producers. And yes, you will get a lot of seedlings coming up. If you can catch them early enough, if you can get them when they're very small, like when they're about only about 3 to 4 inches above the ground, they do pull out. But, you know, if you let them go much longer than that, you just said it, they can produce a very deep root system. Now, if you still pull them, this is one that won't typically come up from that broken root system. So that's still not a bad option to try first and keep at that. The other thing is to try, if you have a red bud in the vicinity, try to rake up those, the seed pods. Don't let them fly into your landscaping, because that's the source of these seedlings. You know, push comes to shove. At the end, if you have a lot of these seedlings that have really become well established, a very, very tight, again, application of an herbicide directly to those small plants, I can take them out. But, you know, that'd be the last resort if you have to do it. Do these other things first.
James, did that help?
Very much. Thank you much.
All right. Thanks so much for the phone call. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks, and it's the monthly gardening show. We're finishing up this hour with our local experts, Hamilton County Extension Agent Joe Boggs and Waterfields Director of Greenhouse Operations and Adjunct Professor at the University of Cincinnati's Horticulture Program, Joshua Jones. We got a bunch of emails to get to and not a bunch of minutes. So it is now the lightning round. So we need your quick answers to these questions from our listeners. And we got one from Sarah in Union, Kentucky, who asks, I have several plants of perennial salvia variety Maynite in full sun. They have been beautiful and covered with blooms up until the last several weeks. I have religiously deadheaded the blooms and watered and fertilized appropriately. Now they're looking really sad, with leaves that are brown and crinkly, and they have stopped blooming. Is this normal for this time of year, or am I doing something wrong?
Joshua, or do you want me to tackle it?
No, you go right ahead.
Okay, well, the downsized salvia, you know, it shouldn't look that way this time of year. It actually should be coming in its own. Be very careful with two things. Don't over-fertilize and don't over-water. Those plants are somewhat dry adapted. You know, they're in the mint family, and salvia is actually native to Mexico. So you just have to kind of think, well, okay, hot and dry. So don't overwater and don't over-fertilize.
All right, we got an email from Sonia who says, every year our garden and fence line is overtaken with honeyvine milkweed, porcelain berry, and bindweed. It's getting worse every year, and this year it's the worst ever. Any advice for removal, and can I do no-till gardening with these weeds around? Joshua, you want to try this one?
So I think if you've tried, and the problem with bindweed is the more you pull it, it seems much like the tree of heaven, the more that it comes out. I think that you're looking at some sort of chemical application. It sounds like you have tried other methods. So I think I would try to pull out as much foliage as possible, leaving a bit of foliage to remain, and then treating that with glyphosate at a very, very targeted treatment area. So you're not overspraying, but those are all very aggressive climbers and growers. And maybe Joe has something else to add.
Well, I am going to speak for the honeyvine milkweed. That's becoming actually one of my favorite plants. It is native, so don't get too carried away with that. And it's not very good, but it can support monarchs. It's not as good as common milkweed. But, you know, if I were to target any of those weeds, Joshua's I'm sorry for laughing, but the bindweed is like tree of heaven. It's awful.
It's
and
tough.
Porcelain berry is just as bad or worse. It's really getting bad in our area. So target those. If you can leave the honeyvine, again, that's not a bad plant to leave.
Tony in Dayton, Ohio writes, does anybody think vinegar might work on poison ivy and such? Joe, what do you think about using vinegar on poison ivy?
Well, the problem is you have to use a concentration that becomes very dangerous for the applicator. Vinegar has looked good as a weed management, but you got to look at the fine print. You got to go with what we call a technical grade. The percentage is so high that if you accidentally get that blowing into your face, it can cause permanent blindness, and that's happened with people. So I'm very hesitant about vinegar because at the concentration you can buy over the counter, you may hurt the plant a little bit, but certainly poison ivy, it may burn the edges, but it's not going to do anything long term. Joshua, anything else to add with that? Have you been working with any of the vinegar or anything like that?
I mean, Joshua, there's nowhere near it's as fun as the blowtorch.
Oh, I know.
No,
that's
not
what I would choose too.
Anecdotally, I have done over the counter vinegar and Epsom salt, and just like you said, Joe, you might see a little knockdown, you might slow it down, but even with multiple reapplications, the plant is just too strong for vinegar to really have a major effect.
And Carol in Green Hills writes with a little advice. She says, if listeners happen to be very allergic to poison ivy, my suggestion is to shower after working in the yard using Dawn soap and a bath scrubby. This will successfully remove the oils. Thanks for that tip, Carol.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
That. And yeah. Claire writes in to say, in the discussion about poison ivy, it was implied that poison ivy is a non-native invasive. She says poison ivy is a native and belongs naturally in our woods, though I can personally testify that it can be an inconvenient native. Joe, I think that might have just been misunderstood. I mean,
Yeah. I think maybe I may have goofed there because I was talking about two non-natives, poison hemlock and wild parsnip. But
right.
I didn't mean to imply, I certainly didn't mean to imply poison ivy is a non-native. It is a native. Yes.
Absolutely. We got an email from Tyler who says, one, he's a big fan of the show. So thank you, Tyler. And also, my parents have a large walnut tree in their yard with a flower bed around the base. They have always had trouble getting any plants to grow underneath the tree. They were told that walnut trees excrete a natural herbicide to ward off competing plants. Is this true? If so, is there any natural substance to combat this herbicide, or are there plants that are naturally resistant to the herbicide? Joshua, is this something you can help with?
So he's exactly right. There is a naturally exuded chemotoxin. It is typically kind of transferred to the soil by both the hulls of the walnuts themselves as well as the leaves. So I highly recommend trying to rake out that bed as best you can, get all those walnuts that fall out as best you can. I know the roots will also exude the same chemotoxin, but not to the same levels as it's transferred by the leaves and the walnuts. As for something to combat it, other than just kind of sanitation, I don't have any products. Joe, do you know of any products that can combat that?
No, the juglones is a very difficult chemical. It will break down on its own over time, but no, there's really nothing. And I hate to say this, the information that we have relative to plants that can withstand juglones exposure is all anecdotal, and so that means that we can't be certain that everything that's on the list will actually work. There are some plants that are more tolerant, but again, there's a little bit of trial and error. Just don't plant a garden near at hand, right, Joshua? Tomatoes are extremely sensitive.
They are.
All right. I'll need some help with this question emailed by Elaine, because I think the key word in it is spelled a couple of different ways. So I don't know if we're talking about Monarda or Mondera. Does either of that sound familiar? It's a bee balm.
Yeah, Monarda.
Monarda. Yeah, okay, right, yeah. So she says the rose color Monarda I planted and replanted several seasons ago is great. The red color the landscaper planted on the other side of my front steps grew too tall and flopped over. She's wondering, are there different types? Can I make the red ones grow shorter and stronger by trimming them before they bloom next year? Joe?
Trimming isn't very good, but there are a lot. It's one of my favorite plants. There are a lot of different types. So what she needs to do is just, before purchasing and planting, there are some that grow lower, don't quite become as leggy, but I love them because they're great for pollinators, and I'm painting with a broad brush. There are a lot of different types, so start out with selection. Look for those that specifically state that they are low growing, that they don't quite, become as tall as others, and go with selection first.
Nazrin writes in to say, "Dear Mr. Monks and panel, is it true that one should not plant tomato plant in the same spot 2 years in a row?" Joshua.
So the best practices, no, you should always practice a crop rotation, especially if you have things like early blight or some other fungal or bacterial diseases in the area. That being said, sometimes, I always prescribe putting the right plant in the right place, meaning, that could be the only spot in your yard that has full sun. So it doesn't mean that you can't get away with it. You just have to be more cautious and more proactive about treating for some of these diseases that tomatoes go through. And one thing that might help is planting a cover crop after the tomato season is over. Plant a cover crop. It'll help revitalize. It'll help revitalize that soil and combat any fungal or bacterial issues you're having in that area if you don't have the option to do a proper crop rotation. So best practices would be to change spots every year, but sometimes that's just not possible, so we have to kind of make do.
All right. Good luck with that, Nazrin. Again, we're joined by Joe Boggs, Hamilton County Extension agent, and Joshua Jones, who is an adjunct professor at the University of Cincinnati's Horticulture Program and also Waterfield's Director of Greenhouse Operations. Before we went on the air, Joe, you sent me this alert that was published by the Ohio State University, and I want to just note that this is about something called the spotted lanternfly. I'm going to read a little bit for our listeners. It says, on Friday, June 23rd, the Indiana Department of Natural Resources announced the first detection of the spotted lanternfly in the state of Indiana. It goes on to say that it was found in Switzerland County, not far from here, earlier in that week. It's the farthest west that insect has been found. This is a federally regulated invasive species, and apparently it has detrimental impact upon plant growth and fruit production, especially in vineyards and orchards. Okay, Joe, the spotted lanternfly, what do we need to know?
Well, first of all, it's a very showy insect. It's not a fly. It actually is, it's in a group called plant hoppers. But this thing is like a plant hopper on steroids. The adults are about an inch long. They're very showy. A lot of times people see the adults, they think that they are moths. These are sucking insects, so they're like giant aphids, so they do pull out a lot of sap from the plants they're attacking. Their primary host is Tree of Heaven. You might say, well, that's not bad based on the earlier call. However, they also affect over 100 different other plants. Now, this is not like emerald ash borer or Asian longhorn beetle. We're not looking at an outright killer of all the different trees and everything like that, but it can very seriously affect grapevines, for example, fruit trees, hops. You know, when you take hops and grapes together, that just eliminates all the adult beverages, doesn't it, Michael?
So it we have sounds like bad news.
Because that's a very awful thing. But at the end of the day, what we're mainly concerned about are two things. One, detection. So if listeners would go online and look this up so we can be aware of it, if it made its way to Indiana, the thought is maybe it was brought there accidentally during a move from the Philadelphia area. That's kind of the thinking. But it can be moved around. Its primary way of being moved around is by people transporting it. So we want people to be aware of it. I don't know what's going to happen with this population. I can tell you it's rampant in eastern Indiana, Maryland, and parts of Virginia. You go online, you can see where it is. Northeast Ohio has some populations that they are treating to try to suppress it. Again, I don't know what's going to happen in Indiana, but we need to be aware and detect it because we're not entirely sure of its entire potential for impact. I can say this, in areas in Pennsylvania, if anybody lives in the Philadelphia area, they will tell you, huge numbers show up as adults a little bit later in the season, a couple of weeks from now, and they show up in big numbers. So it's a real strong nuisance pest. But also, they suck so many juices out of trees that we are concerned about small trees in particular being stressed by this feeding behavior that can then lead them to be susceptible to other problems. So just be very aware of it. It's now kind of a clear and present danger.
We'll be on the lookout for that spotted lantern fly. I also want to give an update to something we discussed on one of our gardening shows. It might have been last month or maybe even the month before, but the Kentucky Fish and Wildlife Department sent an update just this morning that it continues to investigate those mysterious deaths involving birds. It said that received more than 2,000 reports of sick or dying birds through its online system since June 17 when that portal went open. The number of daily reports coming in has steadily declined since the end of June, but it's still reviewing all reports and believes approximately 265 of those reports are related to that unexplained illness. And of local interest to that, based on that analysis, the Kentucky Fish and Wildlife Department continues to encourage residents in Boone, Campbell, and Kenton, along with three other Kentucky counties, to stop feeding birds and follow other statewide guidance. So we'll continue to follow that story as well. Joe Boggs, Joshua Jones, great job today. Always a pleasure to have you both on. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thanks
well,
so
thank
much.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Michael. You take care.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder, assistant producer Nick Swartzel, technical director Josh Elstro. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again tomorrow.